The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic Traveler and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin our journey on the beautiful road. An epic drive through New Zealand reveals a nation of warmth and wonder. Appearing in the June-July 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler, the article is written by Carrie Miller, who also lives in New Zealand. So let us begin our journey. I was expecting to cross paths with a T-Rex at any moment. The rugged west coast of New Zealand's South Island can seem prehistoric like that, half walking, half sliding down a narrow trail overhung with trees dripping tangled moss. I was looking for Merv. I had started my search in Jackson Bay, a quiet fishing village with only a handful of year-round residents and about 30 houses. As I got out of my car, a slender woman with short blonde hair called out to me from a sunny porch, where she was drinking a cup of coffee. She took one look at me and asked if I was lost. "I'm looking for Merv," I said. It was actually a question. "He's up the river whitebaiting," she replied. "I'm his wife. I'll tell you how to find him." Well, this was how I ended up in bush bashing on a muddy trail looking for Merv's whitebaiting stand. Whitebaiting stands are gangplank-looking, cobbled-together docks reaching out over rivers, feeding into the ocean, the perfect vantage points from which to net juvenile galaxidae, a prized fish delicacy. I was on an epic road trip, traveling from Land's End Hotel in Bluff, the southern tip of the South Island, to Cape Ringa, at the top of North Island. Even after 15 years of living here, a New Zealand road trip is my favorite travel experience. There is a feeling throughout this land, a warmth, a welcoming, a sense of being looked after that is difficult to put your finger on. The Maori word is manakitanga. Loosely translated, the word means hospitality. This culture of looking after one another came to worldwide attention in the aftermath of the March 2019 terrorist attack on two Christchurch mosques. The way New Zealanders responded to the tragedy, rallying together with a national call of "This Isn't Us," the outpouring of messages of inclusion, was an example of manaakitanga in action. My road trip was inspired by my manaakitanga, its itinerary decided by people I met along the way, their recommendations, their generosity, their good graces, as I traveled from one connection to the next on a daisy chain of friendly gestures. It was a pattern I knew well after years of living here. Some of my best moments in this country have been serendipitous, like the wrong turn that introduced me to a remote hamlet that netted me an impromptu invitation to a birthday party. My search for Merv had begun at a birthday gathering in Bluff exactly 3 days and 285 miles earlier. I was sitting in the lounge of Land's End with its facade of windows facing the ocean. I met the owner and birthday celebrant, Linda Jackson, when I checked in, and now I was drinking a beer with her, her husband Ross, and another guest, Gay Bertaco from Christchurch. The mood in the tavern felt both lovely and lonely, fitting for a bar at the end of the world. "I'm here to pick up my husband, Mark," Gay said. "He's a fisherman, and he's been out to sea for a week. He's tired, you see, and I worry about him driving all the way back to Christchurch." As if on cue, Mark Muir chose that very moment to walk in the door. "I'm fine," he said, and the mood shifted. A few B-Man beers later, Gay and Mark invited me to join them for dinner at Oyster Cove, the restaurant next door. Over locally sourced spiny rock lobster and mutton bird, a Kiwi specialty in traditional Maori kai, or food, we watched the fishing boats returning, their red and green lights winking in the dark as Mark told us stories of the sea. "I grew up fishing in Greymouth. There are some real characters on the West Coast," Mark said. "You should look up Merv Valensky in Jackson Bay if you go that way. Merv's the biggest character of them all. He's been fishing as long as I've been alive. He'd give me the shirt off his back, or give, rather, the shirt off his back to anyone, and they want to give their shirts to him. He'll be all right if you tell him I sent you. Well, muddy and merciless, I returned from my hike through what was seemingly the Cretaceous period to Jackson Bay. There wasn't much to this place but beauty. The beach and remy-shaded road dead-ended in a settlement with a few houses, a bright orange cafe with a blue roof, the Craypot, and a long weathered wharf extending into the turquoise sea. It was a slice, rather, of unspoiled paradise, one of the many places in this country that visitors, even locals, rarely see, 32 miles off the beaten track south of Haast. Back on the sun-soaked porch, as I was telling Liz Valensky, Merv's wife, about my lack of success tracking him down, Merv pulled up in his truck. "There's the old bugger now," Liz said. "I'll get some tea." Well, Merv greeted me with a polite reserve, offering a handshake that could crush bricks. I told him Mark Muir sent me. "My brother worked for Mark for a long time," Merv said. Mark's got a well-built boat." We talked for about an hour. Merv was one of those fascinating people who's done a little bit of everything. An army stint in Malaysia, Borneo, and Thailand, deer antler velvet harvesting, sawmill work, a lifetime of fishing, and now stone carving. "We've been in Jackson Bay for more than 40 years," Merv told me. "There was nothing here when we came, and there's no place I'd rather be. But people miss it. You got to get down the side roads and have a look. That's where you meet the workers. Go and talk to them, and you'll learn 10 times more than you would in any tourist town. That's where you see New Zealand." Merv and Liz sent me away with a friendly wave and 2 parting gifts, the phone number of an old army buddy of Merv's living in Hokitika, and a cooked crayfish wrapped in a page of the Otago Daily Times for my lunch. I was 733 miles north of Jackson Bay, just inland from the west coast of the North Island this time, at the Wangamoma Hotel. It's perhaps the most remote country hotel in New Zealand, located on the Forgotten World Highway, State Highway 43, that runs between Stratford and Tamarunui. And Wangamoma is New Zealand's only republic, having declared its independence 30 years ago. The Forgotten World Highway is one of those places you hear about, but, well, you sometimes forget. A Wellington-based friend reminded me about it on my way north, and I found myself there drinking beer from a borrowed glass. "This is the only watering hole within an hour's drive, so the locals gather here," said Vicky Pratt. She and her husband Richard own the Wangamoma Hotel. Handles New Zealand speak for pint glasses hung on the wall, each bearing a yellow cattle tag, ear tag, rather, with an identifying number. I was drinking from number 13. "That's Pete's glass. He lives in the wool shed down the road," Vicky said. "I don't think he'll mind." If someone is trying to reach a Forgotten World Highway local who doesn't have a phone, they call the hotel, leave a message with Vicky or Richard. They, in turn, leave a note in the person's beer glass. "Handle mail, it works well," Vicky grinned. As we were chatting, a baby pig streaked into the bar, gamboling about the forest green carpet and racing around the large barrels that double as tables. It was followed by a more hesitant lamb named Roast and 2 tired-looking cyclists seeking a hot meal and a place to pitch a tent. The pig and Roast were ushered back outside while I joined Jamie Lessard and Elena Correa, 20-something Nova Scotians who were 10 months into a planned 15-month trip for a drink. "We're riding our visa as long as we can," Jamie said. They had spent the winter in the Coromandel Peninsula and were now cycling south. "We never would have biked here if someone we met hadn't told us about it. It's totally rerouted us," said Elena. Visitors to Wangamoma have traditionally been New Zealanders, but in the past 2 years, it's been attracting more overseas travelers, most of them straight through day trips to collect novelty Republic stamps on their passports. "We take in about $16,000 a year over the bar in the community selling Wangamoma passports and memorabilia," Vicky said. "It would be nice if some of these international visitors would stay longer. The ones that do stay have a really good time. We look after them. This is a great place to meet locals." Once a bustling frontier outpost of 300 residents at its 1895 settling, Wangamoma now has 10 or 11 town residents, with maybe 120 in the wider area, Richard told me. We were sitting in front of the fire, looking at old photographs. The Forgotten World Highway hadn't changed much, parts of it just two lanes and unsealed, seeming to wind forever from here to there. A boundary battle split the region in half, kindling the revolution that led to the Republic. You can't just change the boundary and change where the people are from, Richard says, and they didn't consult us. Initially, it was a gesture, but we've always taken a little pleasure in the rebellion. We're a stubborn, amiable people. I think that applies to all New Zealanders, Vicky added. We look at each other, especially in rural communities. Manukatanga is what I grew up with, even if I didn't know the name for it. I think it has to do with the fact that everyone knows each other in New Zealand. Guests come in, and within three sentences, I'll know someone they know, and I like that. My kayaking guide, Kate Disberry, and I realized we had both lived in the same tiny beach town, population 4,848, 30 miles northwest of Wellington, New Zealand's capital. It's rare to find someone who knows where Rimati Beach is, much less has lived there. It's that three sentences connection Vicky talked about. I was on a kayaking tour with Cathedral Cove Kayaks in Heihai and on the Coromandel Peninsula. The cycling Nova Scotians had told me Cathedral Cove was a must-visit destination, with its lush landscape, secret coves, and hot water beaches only 2.5 hours' drive from Auckland, the country's largest city. This siren song town is a place that makes visitors seriously study property listings. It has about 400 permanent residents, but that number explodes with New Zealand holidaymakers during the summer. Cathedral Cove, two secluded beaches joined by a soaring arch, can be reached by a one-hour walking track or by water. I chose the water. Our three-hour kayak tour led us across the clear green waters of the Wananui Aihai Marine Reserve. This productive reserve has seen a huge increase in marine life since its establishment 26 years ago. Signs were evident everywhere I looked, from the multitude of ocean birds on their rock perches drying their wings to bright flashes of fish to the dozen small stingrays that zoomed around in the aptly named Stingray Bay. From here, Andy Murrah, our lead kayak guide, pointed out to us the Mercury Islands in the distance. This area is where Captain Cook pinpointed the transit of Mercury in New Zealand, he said, which brought me to the arrival point of another great voyager, Kupe, the extraordinary navigator of Maori legend. I had traveled 370 miles north of Coromandel Peninsula to Cape Ringa, the northernmost point of New Zealand that's accessible to visitors, and the end point of my own voyage. A short white lighthouse crowned a dragon snout stretch of land marked only by an ancient Pohutukawa tree, as two bodies of water, the Tasman Sea and the Pacific Ocean, tussled and surged together, creating a white line in the waves. This place is significant as the landing spot of Kupe, who found his way here thousands of years ago from the eastern Pacific. But Cape Ringa is also important as the place from which a Maori person's spirit departs on its way to the next world. When I look back on this road trip from one end of New Zealand to the other, I remember how the ocean beyond Cape Ringa whispered to me of the wide world beyond these islands, and also how that gnarled Pohutukawa tree at the Cape's tip, enduring and beautiful, spoke more loudly of all the reasons I'd made this land my home. Recently I heard that Murr passed away. I had met him only one time, but he was a larger than life, a person I won't forget, and the embodiment of Manukatanga. And Carrie Smith, by the way, is the author of 100 Dives of a Lifetime, loves to dive, and his book is available through National Geographic Books if you'd like to explore that. Now, included with her article here in the National Geographic Traveler are what are called Travel-Wise Tips on Visiting New England. Let's give you some of those. Here's what you need to know. Traveling during New Zealand's spring and fall allows greater spontaneity. During the summer months, December through February, New Zealanders go on holiday and tourist numbers surge. You can check out TransferCar, that's transfercar.co.nz, that's transfercar.co.nz for rental car deals. Road trips are often one way, stranding rental cars at different branches. This service offers tourists great deals, free to minimal charges, for returning rental cars within a set time frame. You'll have the most luck if you're traveling from south to north. The majority of New Zealand's roads are two lanes and winding. Trying to do more than 3 hours of driving a day means you'll zoom through all the smaller towns and you'll miss exploring. Don't be tempted to pack in too much. Pulling over to let faster drivers pass will endear you to locals who have spent many hours stuck behind camper vans on those narrow roads. Now, where to stay? Well, Land's End at this five-room inn, located at the end of State Highway 1 in Bluff, one of New Zealand's southernmost towns. Location is everything. Ocean views fill guest room windows, and a cozy fire welcomes travelers back after a short hike up Bluff Lookout for a step back in time at the Bluff Maritime Museum. More information online at landsendhotel.co.nz. That's landsendhotel.co.nz. Then we have the Wangamamona Hotel. Let me spell that for you. This is a heck of a word. It takes up a whole page. Whangamamona. Wangamamona Hotel. This circa 1912 boarding house style hotel has character and serves as the community hub of the Republic of Wangamamona on the North Island. Get your passport stamped before heading up to one of the 16 rooms with shared baths. A wide wooden balcony is the perfect spot to look out on the town. And you can get more information. And again, it's wangamamonahotel.co.nz. That's wangamamonahotel.co.nz. Then there's the Tatahai Lodge Beach Resort, T-A-T-A-H-I. This relaxed lodge on two subtropical acres is a five-minute walk to the white sand beaches for which the Coromandel Peninsula on the North Island is famous. Get more information at tatahilodge.co.nz, T-A-T-A-H-I, the tatahilodge.co.nz. And places to eat, Oyster Cove Restaurant. Diners at this Bluff restaurant enjoy bay vistas while feasting on oysters on the half shell, cloudy bay clams, and dishes such as lamb salad. Oystercove.co.nz gets more information for you online. That's oystercove.co.nz. And finally, there's the Cray Pot. Sit at a shaded outdoor picnic tables while dining on crayfish, other seafood, and burgers at this waterside food shack in tiny Jackson Bay. And pretty easy to find online, thecraypotnz.com. Thecraypotnz.com. Boy, lots of fun in New Zealand, huh? Well, next, our journey takes us from New Zealand to Colorado, where writer Rachel Walker spent time savoring the Colorado Rockies by sailboat. Yep, her article appeared in the August 9, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. You ready to sail? When I arrived at the Frisco Marina on a bright June morning, my two sons, stuffed with pancakes and eager for our upcoming sailing lesson, I was temporarily unnerved. The water on Lake Dillon, a high plain reservoir, elevation 9,071 feet in Frisco, Colorado, was quite still. The surrounding peaks, many covered in snow, reflected on the lake's surface, beautiful but not promising for a day of wind-powered recreation. Nevertheless, we headed out to the dock and met Tom Emmerich, boat captain, instructor, owner of Wind Rider of the Rockies, and a lifelong sailor. About the wind, I ventured as he loaded us aboard and introduced himself to Henry, 9, and Silas, 7. These mountains make their own weather, he said. We'll have wind. It can sometimes be unpredictable, but we'll have it. Thus the lesson began. Aboard a 22-foot Santana heavy weather boat, ideal for the strong winds we do get up here, Tom gave us a tour and explained points of sail or how the boat interacts with the wind. Sailing requires knowing how to orient the boat relative to the wind. It is virtually impossible to sail directly into it. Tom explained the different points in a way that the kids and I both grasped, and he also had a laminated diagram of explaining the points to which we referred throughout the lesson. Before leaving the bay, Tom let the boys explore the cabin where windows were water level and a cushioned berth invited some playtime. They studied Tom's charts and eyed a bucket, the morning's bathroom, if we needed it. Back on deck, Tom explained how the rudder steered the boat and gave each kid a turn. After a few figure eights, we were ready for the open water. We motored out of the marina and into the heart of Lake Dillon, where the wind indeed picked up. Tom cut the engine, raised the mainsail, the jib was already up, and just like that, we were sailing in the mountains. From the lake, I spotted 4 14ers, peaks whose summit are 14,000 feet or higher, of which Colorado has 54. There were many more mountains whose summits range from 10,000 to 13,000 feet above sea level. The view was stunning and the crisp mountain air invigorating. I realized I had never before seen the mountains from such a vantage point. For a lifelong landlubber, it was a unique way to experience the Colorado Rockies, and that's saying a lot. I was born and raised in Colorado and loved to ski, run, and bike through these mountains. I've had many profound, exciting, and even harrowing adventures in the Colorado high country, but sailing, well, this was something different. I loved it. It helps that Lake Dillon, created in the mid-1960s as a drinking water supply for Denver, some 90 miles east, is picturesque and large. It spans 3,300 acres and has 27 miles of shoreline. Jet skis, speedboats, and water skiing are banned. Motorized pontoon boats are allowed, so there were no choppy wakes to navigate. This year, the marina was in the midst of excavating 85,000 cubic yards of dirt and lowering the lake bed's level by about 13 feet, the first phase in a multi-million dollar improvement project. Even with the construction and piles of dirt, my kids and I enjoyed exploring the shoreline and marveling at the bustling activity at the conclusion of our lesson. Then we headed into Frisco to explore. Once a mining town, Frisco is close to better-known places like Breckenridge and Keystone. For years, I thought it was little more than a bedroom community for those who worked at more posh and popular Colorado mountain destinations. I was wrong. Although there are touristy T-shirt shops and a roadside chainsaw-carved wooden animal statue lot, Frisco also has a mix of eclectic restaurants, a small park with an amphitheater where bands give free summer concerts on Thursday nights, and a fascinating historic museum. The self-guided tour takes visitors to 11 buildings, ranging from the town's original jail to the mercantile to the schoolhouse and more. Each building is restored to vintage accuracy and features intensive interpretation and an audio to explain its significance in Frisco's history. Like other Colorado mountain towns, Frisco also boasts a robust trail network, busy with hikers and mountain bikers and nearby whitewater rafting and kayaking. The new adventure park with downhill mountain bike trails and frisbee golf and Nordic skiing in the winter was busy when we stopped by. But I keep coming back to the water and with the equanimity I found on a sailboat on Lake Dillon. It wasn't just the scenery. It was the act of sailing itself, that stealthy centuries-old mode of transportation. Our lesson only lasted several hours. Longer options are available, and I didn't step off the boat a sailor. I did, however, emerge with a strong desire to become one. Rachel Walker writes about travel from her home in Boulder, Colorado, and you can follow her on Twitter. Her Twitter account is at Rachel J. O. Walker. That's at Rachel J. O. Walker if you'd like to find out more about her on Twitter. Now, if you'd like to consider a visit to Frisco, Colorado, Rachel has included some travel tips with her article. If you go, places to stay include Frisco Lodge at the 321 Main Street address there in Frisco, and online you can check it out at friscolodge.com. That's friscolodge.com. Originally a stagecoach stop in the 1800s, this Tyrolean-style bed and breakfast offers cozy rooms reminiscent of the town's pioneering and mining heritage. Guests receive complimentary gourmet breakfast and wine and cheese in the afternoon. Rates started at $150. Now, there's also the Bread and Salt. You'll find this one at 401 East Main Street. Online, it's breadandsaltfrisco.com, breadandsaltfrisco.com. Serving comfort food with a Western twist, this popular eatery offers fresh, locally sourced ingredients and dishes that range from sweet to savory. Don't miss the breakfast Chipotle Pork Benedict. It's open 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week, and the plates start at $7 for breakfast. Then we have a place called Greco's Pastoria, and this is at 311 East Main Street, and online it's grecospastoria.com, GrecosPastoria, GrecosPastoria.com, a casual Italian restaurant. Greco's is known for fresh pasta, homemade sauces, and New York-style thin-crust pizza. The outdoor patio is ideal for people watching, and the spacious dining room is kid-friendly, open 11:30 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily for lunch, happy hour, and dinner. Entrees will start at about $10 at lunchtime. Now, we have the Butterhorn Bakery and Cafe at 401 Main Street. And online, you can check them out at butterhornbakery.com, butterhornbakery.com. Come for the hearty country breakfast. Stay for the flaky homemade croissants and incredible cinnamon rolls. For more than 40 years, the spot has been meeting the breakfast and lunch needs of locals and visitors alike. Prices start at $2.50 for pastries and $10 for breakfast. Then we have a place called the Wind Rider of the Rockies, windrider.us. That's windrider.us for information online. Via lessons, sailboat rentals, tours, and small group or corporate team building, the firm has been spreading the love of sailing in the Colorado high country since the mid-1990s. Won't that be a story to tell your friends when you say, I learned how to sail in Colorado? Well, owner Tom Emmerich was raised in Colorado, but has sailed around the world. Lessons on the 22-foot Santana start at $245 for 2 hours. A two-hour rental for that same boat cost $130. The sailing season generally runs from about mid-June to early September. If you want to learn more about this and other items around Frisco, check it out at townoffrisco.com, townoffrisco.com. That is quite the place there, Frisco, Colorado, right? So maybe you'll get a chance to enjoy that, and hopefully you do. Well, why do you travel? That's one of the things that we always ask, and it's a question that appears regularly in the Virtuoso Traveler magazine. In the June-July 2019 issue, David Hockman interviews a couple with a commitment of a life to never-ending adventure or travel. And we start out with Judy Fares gets so enthusiastic when talking about travel. You sometimes need to slow her down. She and her husband, Paul Scott Fares, who split time between homes in Connecticut, Baltimore, and Manhattan, visited all seven continents, in 2018. And there's no let up in sight. We caught up with her just before a trip to Cuba. They're also hitting Baja California, Montreal, Tahiti, Tonga, and Australia this year before a Caribbean New Year's cruise with Sea Dream Yacht Club. Virtuoso travel advisor Rhonda Wendler of Baltimore, Maryland, keeps the couple moving and moving and moving. So let's see what David Hockman has learned from Judy. And she says, my number is 81. A few more new countries this year, and I'll be up to 90 countries visited. Wow. She adds, I didn't grow up traveling. I grew up in the Midwest and learned to speak French. I became fluent while studying abroad in Paris and Barcelona, where I learned Spanish. After college, I backpacked through Europe, and then after graduate school through India, Thailand, and Indonesia, and that opened up the world for me. She said, when I first met Scott through a mutual friend, we bonded over travel. He was talking about taking his 13-year-old daughter to Disney World, and I had just taken my 12-year-old son. We were on the same plane, fast passes, Space Mountain, and all that stuff. We decided a few years ago that we would travel full-time. Scott's 67, I'm 57. We've been married for 7 years. He was in tech. I worked in advertising, banking, and marketing. Retiring to see the world and learning as much as we can about people, animals, food, and geography, it's the best decision we've ever made. So there you go. Quite an interesting tour there for Judy Fares and her husband, Scott, as they tell us why they travel. Well, we've run out of time for our episode of Armchair Traveler today. Hope you'll listen next time that you've enjoyed your journey. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138.